Here, more than any other place in the city, Venli felt she could look into the past and see the history of her people. Gone was the ornate but boring human fortress. In its place stood a grand construction that used many of the original foundations and walls, but expanded upon them in a unique design. Instead of boxy lines, it contained grand arcs, with large ridges sweeping down from the sides like curved blades. These multiplied toward the top, the ridges rising to points. The result was a curved conical shape, the peak resembling a crown. The architecture had a distinctly organic feel, enhanced by walls grown over with shale bark to give a rough, uneven texture. The palace vaguely resembled a plant, bulging at the base, with gentle blades sweeping up to the cap. Venli approached, attuned to tension. The last 20 hours had been a chaotic jumble as she'd accompanied Leshwe through the city, meeting with other fused, looking for information. Venli didn't completely understand why it had set Leshwe off, but a new group of fused spirits had awakened and come for bodies. That wasn't unexpected. Some of the fused on Brays slumbered, or hibernated, meditated. They were coming aware in groups and joining the battle. But several in particular had Leshwe worried, perhaps terrified. After a day of chaos spent investigating with Leshwe, Venli had awakened to thunder early in the morning, the Everstorm. Right after it, she'd received word. A conclave of the most important singers had been called to the palace. As voice, Venli was expected to arrive quickly and on her own, for Leshwe would take the entrance provided for the Shanae'im above. Venli tried to calm herself as she walked by focusing on the beautiful palace structure. She wished she could have lived in a time when this architecture was commonplace. She imagined entire cities made of these transfixing arcs, one part dangerous, one part beautiful, like the natural world. "We did this," she thought. When Esh and I first returned from the human lands, she spoke to awe about the grand creations of the humans. But we did things like this too. We had cities, we had art, we had culture. The rebuilding of the palace had been overseen and accomplished by several fused of a tall, limber variety called Fanan'im, those ones of alteration. Though all fused were trained as warriors, many had other skills. Some were engineers, scientists, architects. She thought perhaps they'd all once been soldiers before being granted immortality, but the time they'd had to grow since was expansive. What would it be like to live so many lives? Such wisdom and such capacity. Seeing such things awakened emotions within her. Not just awe, but craving. Were new fused being made? Could someone like her aspire to this immortality? Timber pulsed a warning inside her, and Venli forcibly resisted those instincts. It was not easy. Perhaps as a surge binder, she should have been naturally selfless, naturally noble, like Esh and I. Venli was neither. A part of her still longed for the path she'd once imagined, blessed by the fused for opening the way to their return, heaped with honors for being the first among her people to listen to the Voidspren, bringer of the Everstorm. Should she not have become a queen for these actions? Timber pulsed another warning, comforting this time. Odium would never give her these honors. Venli had been deceived. Her lusts had led to great pain and destruction. She needed a way to balance her heritage and her goals. She was determined to escape the rule of the fused, but that did not mean she wanted to abandon singer culture. Indeed, the more she discovered about the singers of old, the more she wanted to know. She reached the top of the steps, and passed by two of the Fanan'im, the altered ones, with limber 7-foot-tall bodies and piles of hair that sprouted only from the very tops of their heads, tumbling down around the carapace that covered the rest of their skulls. These two had not been among those who had built the palace, for they sat with vacant stares. Timber pulsed to the rhythm of the lost. Gone. Like so many of the fused, their minds had been claimed by the infinite cycle of death and rebirth. Perhaps there was a reason not to envy their immortality. The inner entryway of the palace had been rebuilt with sweeping staircases. Walls had been removed, and dozens of rooms had been combined. In the large chambers, they didn't shut the windows during storms. They simply rolled up the carpets. Venli climbed all the way to the 5th floor, entering a pinnacle room added by the fused architects. Large and cylindrical, it was the center of the crown shape. This place was the home of the 9, leaders of the fused. Other voices were gathering. There were some 30 of them. She'd been led to believe that there would be as many as 100, once all the fused were awake. This room wouldn't hold that many voices, even if they lined up shoulder to shoulder. As it was growing crowded, as each voice found their place before their master. Leshwe hovered a few feet off the ground near the other heavenly ones, and Venli hastened over. She looked up, and Leshwe nodded, so Venli thumped the butt of her staff on the stones, indicating her master was ready. The 9 were already there, of course. They couldn't leave. They'd been entombed in stone. 9 pillars adorned the center of the chamber, rising in a circle. The stones had been soul-cast into shape, with people inside them. The 9 lived here, permanently melded into the pillars. Again, there was an organic feel to the construction, as if the pillars had grown there like trees around the 9. The pillars twisted and tapered, shrinking and growing into the chests of the 9, but leaving their heads and the tops of their carapaced shoulders bare. Most had at least one arm free. The 9 faced inward, their backs to the room. The bizarre entombment was discomforting, alien, nauseating. It lent the 9 an air of permanence to accent their ageless nature. The pillars seemed to say, "These are older than the stones. They have lived here long enough for the rock to grow over them, like Krem reclaiming the ruins of a fallen city." Then they couldn't help but be impressed by their dedication. Being locked into motionlessness like this had to be agonizing. The 9 did not eat, subsisting on odium's light alone. Surely this entombment wasn't good for their sanity. Though, if they really did want to leave their imprisonment, they could simply have themselves killed. A fused could also will their spirit from their body, freeing it to seek another host. Indeed, the humans had tried imprisoning fused as a method of defeating them, but had found it to be futile. So the 9 could leave, if they wanted. In that light, these tombs were a flagrant, wasteful act. The ultimate price for this show was paid not by the 9, but by the poor singers they had killed to give themselves bodies. The 9 must have counted the knocking of the staffs on the ground, for they raised their heads in unison once the final High Lord was in place. Venli glanced at Leshwe, who was humming softly to agony, the new rhythm that was a counterpart to anxiety. "What is happening?" Venli whispered to Craving. "What does this have to do with the new fused who have awakened?"
"Watch," Leshwe whispered, "but take care. Remember, what power I have outside is a mere candle's light in here."
Leshwe was, for a high lady, low-ranked, a field commander, but still merely a soldier. She was both the very crust of the unimportant and the very dregs of the important. She was always careful in walking that line. The nine hummed together, then began singing in unison, a song and rhythm Venli had never heard. It sent chills through her, particularly when she realized she couldn't understand the lyrics. She felt near to comprehending. It was almost within reach, but her powers seemed to shy back from this song, as though, if she could understand, her mind would not be able to handle the meaning. She was fairly certain what this indicated. Odium, the god of the singers, was watching this conclave. She knew his touch, his stench. He was forbidding any of the voices from interpreting this song. It died down, and silence claimed the chamber.
"We would hear a report," one of the nine said at last.
Venli had trouble telling who spoke, since they were all facing one another.
"A first-hand account of what was seen at the recent clash in northern Avendla."
Avendla was their name for Alethkar. Venli's powers instantly knew the meaning of the word. Land of the Second Advance. Her abilities stopped there, however, and she couldn't answer the more interesting question. Why was it called that? Leshwe hummed, so Venli stepped forward and cracked her scepter against the floor twice, then bowed, head down. Leshwe rose behind her, clothing rustling.
"I will have Zandiel provide sketches. The large human ship flew of its own power, using no gemstones we could see, though certainly they were embedded somewhere inside."
"It flew by lashings,"
one of the nine said.
"The work of wind runners."
"No," Leshwe said. "It did not have that appearance or that feel. This was a device, a machine, created by their artifabrians."
The nine sang together, and their alien song made timber, deep within Venli, pulse nervously.
"We were away far too long," one of the nine said. "It has let the humans fester like an infection, gaining strength. They create devices we have never known."
"We are behind them, not ahead," another said. "It is a dangerous position from which to fight."
"No," said a third. "They have made great strides in understanding the prisons of Spren, but they know little about the bond, the power of oaths, the nature of the tones of the world. They are Kremlings building a nest beneath the shadow of a great temple. They take pride in what they have done, but cannot grasp the beauties around them."
"Still," said the first, "still, we could not have crafted the flying device they have. Why would we? We have the Shanaim."
Venli remained bowed, hand on her staff. Holding the pose exactly grew uncomfortable, but she would never complain. She was as close to important events as a mortal could get, and she was certain she could use the knowledge to some advantage. The nine spoke for the ears of those listening. They could have conversed quietly, but these meetings were about the spectacle.
"Leshwe," one of the nine said, "what of the suppressor we sent to be tested? Did it work?"
"It worked," Leshwe said, "but it was also lost. The humans captured it. I fear this will lead them to further explorations and discoveries."
"This was poorly handled," said one of the fused.
"I take no responsibility for this error," Leshwe said. "You must speak to the pursuer to find record of the mistake."
Each spoke with formal tones and rhythms. Venli had the impression that the nine knew how these answers would play out.
Lesion,
the nine called together.
You will... Oh, dispense with the pageantry,
a loud voice said. A tall fused emerged from the shadows on the far side of the room. Leshwe lowered down, and Venli straightened and stepped back into line before her master. That gave her a good view of this new fused, which was of a variety that Venli had never seen. Enormous, with jagged carapace and deep red hair, the being wore only a simple black wrap for clothing. Or was his hair the clothing? It seemed to meld with the wrap. Fascinating. Nexim, those ones of husks. The ninth brand of fused. She had heard them spoken of. Supposedly very few existed. Was this the recently awakened fused who had Leshwe so concerned?
Lesion, the pursuer, said one of the nine. You were entrusted with a delicate device, a suppressor of stormlight abilities. You were told to test it. Where is this device? I tested it,
Lesion snapped, showing little of the formality or respect others gave the nine.
It didn't work. You are certain of this? The nine asked. Was the man invested when he attacked you? You think I could be defeated by a common human?
The pursuer demanded.
This windrunner must be of the fourth ideal. Something I was led to believe had not yet happened. Perhaps our reconnaissance teams have lost their edge during the long time spent between returns.
Behind Venli, Leshwe hummed sharply to conceit. She did not like that implication.
Regardless, the pursuer said, I was killed. The Windrunner is more dangerous than any of us were led to believe. I must pursue him now, as is my right by tradition. I will leave immediately.
Curious, Venli thought. If he'd fought Stormblessed, then he could not be the newly awakened one that Leshwe feared. The pursuer stood with arms crossed as the nine began to sing to one another again, softer than before. In the past, such deliberations had taken several minutes. Many of the other fused began conferring quietly as they waited. Venli leaned back, whispering, Who is he, lady?
A hero,
Leshwe responded to withdrawal.
And a fool. Millennia ago, Lesion was the first fused to be killed by a human. To avoid the shame of such death, upon returning to life, Lesion ignored all orders and rational arguments, and went into battle seeking only the man who had killed him. He was successful, and his tradition was born. Any time he is killed, Lesion ignores everything else until he has claimed the life of the one who killed him. 7,000 years, and he's never failed. Now the others, even those chosen as the nine, encourage his quests.
I thought, in the past, you were exiled to Braze once you died? How could he return to hunt the one who had killed him? Much of this was still confusing to Venli. For thousands of years, the humans and the singers had fought many rounds of an eternal war. Each new wave of attacks had involved what was called a return, when the fused would descend to Roshar. The humans called these desolations. There was something special about the way the human heralds interacted that could lock the fused on Braze, the land called Damnation by the humans. Only once the fused broke the heralds through torture, sending them back to Roshar, could a return be initiated. This cycle had played out for millennia, until the last desolation, where something had changed. Something to do with a single herald and an unbreakable will.
You mistake the cycle. Simplify it, Leshwe said softly. We were only locked on Braes once the heralds died and joined us there. Until then, there would often be years or even decades of rebirths during a return, during which time the heralds would train humans to fight. Once they were confident that humans could continue to stand, the heralds would give themselves to Braes to activate the isolation. The heralds would need to die for this to work.
But they didn't die the last time, Venli said. They remained, but you were still locked away.
Yes, Leshwe said. They somehow found a way to shift the Oath Pact to depend on a single member.
She nodded toward the pursuer.
Regardless, before an isolation began, that one always managed to find and kill any humans who had bested him. As soon as the isolation was begun, he'd kill himself, so he'd never return to Braes permanently after having died by human hand. As I said, the others encourage his tradition. He is allowed to act outside command structures, given leeway to pursue. When he is not hunting one who killed him, he seeks to fight the strongest of the enemy Radiants.
That sounds like a worthy passion, Venli said, picking her words carefully.
Yes, it does sound like one, Leshwe said to derision. Perhaps it would be in someone less reckless. Lesion has endangered our plans, undermined strategies, and ruined more missions than I can count. And he's growing worse. As all of us are, I suppose.
He was killed by the Windrunner hero? Venli asked. The one they call Stormblessed?
Yes, yesterday. And the Radiant's powers were suppressed at the time, no matter what Lesion said. Stormblessed is not yet of the fourth ideal. I would know. This is doubly a shame on the pursuer. He grows careless, overly confident. These Radiants are new to their powers, but that does not make them less worthy.
You like them, Venli said, cautiously broaching the topic. The Windrunners. Leshwe was silent for a moment.
Yes, she said. They and their spren would make excellent servants, should we be able to subdue them.
So she was open to new ideas, new ways of thinking. Perhaps she would react favorably to the idea of a new nation of listeners.
Announce me, voice, Leshwe said.
Now? Venli said, shocked out of her contemplations. While the nine are conferring? Leshwe hummed to command, so Venli scrambled to obey, stepping forward and slamming the butt of her staff against the floor, then bowing. The nine interrupted their song, and the one who spoke said the words to destruction.
What is this, Leshwe?
I have more to say, Leshwe proclaimed to command. The pursuer is losing control. He approaches the state where his mind and intentions cannot be trusted. He was defeated by a common human. It is time for special privileges to be revoked.
Lesion spun toward her, shouting to destruction,
How dare you!
You are low to make such a declaration, Leshwe, one of the nine said.
This is both above and beneath you at once.
I speak my passion, she said. The man who killed the pursuer has killed me. I claim prior privilege to the life of Stormblessed. The pursuer must in this case wait upon my pleasure.
You know my tradition,
he shouted at Leshwe. Traditions can be broken. The tall fused stomped toward her, and Venli had to forcibly hold herself in place, bowing, though she was allowed to look up and watch. This pursuer was enormous, intimidating. He was also nearly out of control, a storm at its height, so angry she couldn't make out the rhythm to his shouted words.
I will hunt you, he shouted. You cannot deny me my vows. My tradition cannot be broken.
Leshwe continued to hover in place unperturbed, and Venli saw an ulterior motive in the conflict. Yes, the nine were humming to derision. In losing his temper, the pursuer proved his passion, a good thing to them, but also risked proving he was going crazy. Leshwe had purposefully goaded him.
We accept Leshwe's prior claim on this man, the nine said. Pursuer, you will not hunt this human until Leshwe has a chance to battle him again. This undermines my entire existence, the pursuer said, pointing at Leshwe. She seeks to destroy my legacy out of spite.
Then you should hope she loses their next conflict, one of the nine said. Leshwe, you may hunt this Windrunner, but know that if a battle comes and he must be removed, another may be granted the task.
This is understood and accepted, Leshwe said. None of them realize she's trying to protect that Windrunner, Venli thought. Maybe she doesn't realize it herself. There were schisms among the fused, cracks much larger than any would admit. What could be done to take advantage of them? Timber pulsed inside her, but in this case, Venli was certain her ambition was well placed. To lack it would be to simply go along with whatever she was told. That was not freedom. Freedom, if she was to seek it, would require ambition, in the right place. The pursuer, still raging to no particular rhythm, stomped out of the conclave chamber. Leshwe settled down behind Venli, humming softly to exultation.
Do not praise yourself overly much, Leshwe, one of the nine called. Do not forget your low station in this room. We have our own reasons for denying the pursuer.
Leshwe bowed her head as the nine returned to their private conversation.
You could be more, Venli whispered, returning to her place beside Leshwe. These are not as clever as you are, lady. Why do you let them continue to treat you so poorly?
I have chosen my station carefully, Leshwe snapped. Do not challenge me on this, voice. It is not your place.
I apologize, Venli said to Agony. My passion outstripped my wisdom.
That was not passion, but curiosity.
Leshwe narrowed her eyes.
Be alert. This matter was not the reason the conclave was called. The danger I've been fearing is yet to come.
That made Venli stand up straighter, on her guard. Eventually the nine stopped singing, but they did not address the leaders of the fused. Instead, the hall fell silent. Moments stretched to minutes. What was happening?
A figure darkened the doorway of the chamber, backlit by sunlight. It was a tall femalean of the Fanan'im, the builders who had created the palace, with a tall topknot of hair and carapace like a helmet, otherwise covering her head. She wore a luxurious robe and was willowy, with a narrow figure and long arms, fingers fully twice the length of Venli's. Leshwe hissed.
Gods, no! Not her!
What? Venli asked, as the room flooded with whispers from the others. Who is she?
I thought her mad, Leshwe said to Agony. How?
The tall fused walked into the room and did a slow, careful loop around the perimeter, perhaps to make certain she was seen by everyone. Then she did something Venli had never seen anyone do, no matter how high. She walked into the center of the nine and looked them in the eyes.
What does it mean, lady? Venli asked.
She was one of the nine for many centuries, Leshwe said, until she decided it was too hampering upon her ambitions. After the last return and her madness, she was to remain asleep.
Why?
Raboniel, Lady of Wishes, one of the nine said. You have brought us a proposal. Please speak it.
It is obvious, Raboniel said, that the humans have been allowed too much time to grow. They run rampant across Roshar. They have steel weapons and advanced military tactics. They outstrip our own knowledge in areas. The one thing they do not yet have is mastery over their powers. There are few among them of the fourth ideal, perhaps only one individual. And they do not have full access to the tower now that the sibling is dead. We must strike now. We must seize the tower from them.
Leshwe moved forward, not waiting for Venli to announce her.
This was tried. We attempted to seize the tower and failed.
That, Raboniel said. That was a stalling tactic intended to isolate the bondsmith. The strike could never have succeeded. I was not involved. You forget your place again, Leshwe, one of the nine said. This makes us wonder if you are the one who is losing her mind.
Leshwe retreated to her spot, and Venli felt the eyes of the other 30 fused and their voices on her, shaming her as they hummed.
You have nearly perfected the suppression fabrials, Raboniel said. Do not forget. It is technology I discovered from the tower itself, thousands of years ago. I have a plan to use it in a more dramatic way. As the sibling is essentially a deadeye, I should be able to turn the tower's defenses against its owners.
A voice across the room stepped forward and thumped his staff, announcing Urium the Defiant.
Pardon, Urium said to Craving, but are you implying that you can suppress the powers of the Radiance inside their own tower?
Yes, Raboniel said. The device preventing us from attacking them there can be inverted. We will need to lure the Elsecaller and the Bondsmith away. Their oaths may be advanced enough to push through the suppression, much as the Unmade have done at the tower in the past. With them gone, I can lead a force into Urithiru and seize it from within, and the Radiance will be unable to resist.
The nine started singing to one another privately, giving everyone else time for conversations. Venli looked to her mistress. Leshwe rarely spent these moments talking to the other high fused. She was beneath most of them, after all.
I don't understand, Venli whispered.
Raboniel is a scholar, Leshwe said, but not the kind you would wish to work beneath. We used to call her Lady of Pains, until she decided she didn't like the title.
Her expression grew distant.
She has always been fascinated by the tower and the connection between radiance. Their oaths, their spren, their surges. During the last return, she developed a disease intended to kill all humans on the planet. Near the end, it was discovered that the disease would likely kill many singers as well. She released it anyway, only to find, to all of our fortunes, that it did not work as expected. Fewer than 1 in 10 humans were killed, and 1 in 100 singers.
That's terrible, Venli said.
Extinction is the natural escalation of this war,
Leshwe whispered.
If you forget why you are fighting, then victory itself becomes the goal. The longer we fight, the more detached we become, both from our own minds and from our original passions.
She hummed softly to abashment.
Explain your plan, Raboniel,
one of the 9 said, loudly enough to cut through conversations.
I will lead a team into the tower, Raboniel said. Then secure control of the sibling's heart. Using my natural talents and the gifts of Odium, I will corrupt that heart and turn the tower to our needs. The humans will fall. Their powers will not work, but ours will. From there, I suspect that, with a little time, I can learn much, studying the gemstones at the sibling's heart. Perhaps enough to create new weapons against the Radiance and the humans.
One of the Heavenly Ones, a Malan named Jeshishin, came forward as his voice wrapped the floor.
As Leshwe said, we did strike at the tower a year ago. True, that attempt was not meant to be a permanent seizure, but we were rebuffed. I would know the specifics of what we will do this time to ensure victory.
We will use the king who has given himself to us, Raboniel said. He has delivered intelligence about guard patterns. We don't need to take the entire tower at first. We simply need to get to the heart and use my knowledge to turn the defenses to our advantage.
The heart is the most well-guarded location,
Jeshishin said. Raboniel spoke to conceit.
Then it is fortunate that we have an agent in their inner circle, is it not?
Jeshishin floated back, his voice returning to his place.
What is her true game?
Leshwe whispered to Craving.
Raboniel has never really been interested in the war or its tactics. This must be about something more. She wants the opportunity to experiment upon the sibling.
This is dangerous,
one of the 9 loudly said to the room.
The humans are suspicious of Taravengian already. He reports that he is watched at all times. If we use his intelligence in this way, there is little doubt he will be compromised entirely. Let him be compromised, Raboniel said. What good is a weapon if you don't swing it? Why have you delayed? The humans are untrained, their powers fledgling, their understanding laughable. I find it embarrassing to awaken and find you struggling against these pitiful shadows of our once mighty enemies. Without the tower, their coalition will disintegrate, as they will be unable to deliver support through the oath gates. We will gain great advantage through the use of those same portals. In addition, this endeavor will give me the opportunity to test some theories I have developed while slumbering these last millennia.
I am increasingly certain I have discovered a path that will lead to an end to the war.
Leshwe hissed out slowly, and Venli felt cold. It seemed that whatever Raboniel thought would end the war would involve techniques best left untouched. The rest of the room, however, appeared impressed. They whispered to subservience, indicating consent to the idea. Even the nine started humming to the rhythm. The fused put on a strong, passionate show, but there was a fatigue to these ancient souls. It underpinned their other passions, like the true color of a dyed cloth. Wash it, leave it out in the storms long enough, and the core shone through. These creatures were fraying, surrendering their minds, their will and very individuality offered up to odium on the altar of eternal war. Perhaps the humans were new to their abilities, untested, but the fused were old axes, chipped and weathered. They would take great risks after so many rebirths, to be finished at last.
"What of Stormblast?"
a voice called out, thickly accented, from the recesses of the grand chamber. Venli found herself humming to abashment as she searched the room. Who had spoken so brashly without first ordering their voice to step forward? She found him sitting on a raised ledge up above, in shadow, right as her mind connected the accent to the lack of decorum. Vire, the human, once called Moash. He dressed like a soldier, with perfectly trimmed hair, a sharp uniform cut after human tailoring. He was an oddity. Why did the nine continue to suffer him? Not only that, why had they given him an honor blade, one of the most precious relics on Roshar? He draped one leg off the ledge, held in his lap, his sword reflected sunlight as the tip moved.
"He'll stop you," Vire said. "You should have a plan for dealing with him."
"Ah, the human," Raboniel said, looking at Vire on his ledge. "I've heard of you. Such an interesting specimen. Odium favors you."
"He takes my pain," Vire said,
"and leaves me to achieve my potential.
You did not answer my question. What of Stormblast?"
"I'm not afraid of a Windrunner, no matter how mythical his reputation may be growing," Raboniel said. "We will focus our attention on the Bondsmith and the Else Caller. They are more dangerous than any simple soldier."
"Well," Vire said, pulling the tip of his sword back into the shadows. "I'm sure you know your business, fused."
The nine, as always, suffered the strange human. His position had been chosen by Odium. Leshwe seemed to think highly of him. Of course, he'd once killed her, and that was a sure way to gain her respect.
"Your proposal is bold, Raboniel," one of the nine said, "and decisive. We have long been without your guidance in this return, and we welcome your passion. We will move forward as you request. Prepare a team for your infiltration of the tower, and we shall contact the human Taravangian with instructions. He can divert the Bondsmith and Else Caller."
Raboniel sang loudly to satisfaction, a stately and decisive sound. Venli was reasonably certain this entire meeting had been for show. The nine had not stopped to debate the plan. They'd known what Raboniel would suggest, and had already worked out the details. The other fused waited respectfully, as Raboniel, her victorious proposal elevating her further in their eyes, walked toward the exit. Only one of the fused moved, Leshwe.
Come, she said, floating after Raboniel.
Venli hurried, joining Leshwi as she intercepted the tall female and just outside the doors. Raboniel looked over Leshwi, humming to derision, as the two emerged into sunlight on the balcony rooftop around the chamber. The stairwell down was to the right.
Why did you seek to block my proposal, Leshwi? Raboniel asked. Have you begun to feel the effects of madness?
I am not mad, but afraid, Leshwi said to abashment,
and Venli started at the words. Lady Leshwi? Afraid?
Do you truly think you can end the war?
I'm certain of it, Raboniel said to derision. I have had a long time to ponder on the discoveries made before the end of the last return.
She reached into the pocket of her robe and removed a gemstone glowing with stormlight, a shifting spren captured inside. A fabril, like the humans created.
They imprisoned some of the unmade in these, Leshwi, Raboniel said. How close do you think they are to discovering they could do the same for us? Can you imagine it? Forever imprisoned in a gemstone, locked away, able to think, but unable to ever break free?
Leshwi hummed to panic, a pained rhythm with unfinished measures and chopped up beats.
One way or another, Raboniel said. This is the final return. The humans will soon discover how to imprison us. If not, well, the best of us who remain are but a few steps from madness. We must find a solution to this war.
You are newly returned, Leshwi said. You have no servants or staff. Your undertaking will require both.
She gestured to the side, to Venli.
I have gathered a staff of faithful and highly capable singers. I would lend them to you for this enterprise, and would attend you myself, as an apology for my objections.
You do always have the best servants, Raboniel said, eyeing Venli.
This one is the last listener, is she not? Once voice of Odium himself? How did you collect her?
Timber pulsed inside Venli. She was annoyed by the term collect, and Venli felt the same. She bowed her head and hummed to subservience, to keep from revealing her true feelings.
She was cast off by Odium, Leshwi said. I have found her an excellent voice.
The daughter of traitors, Raboniel said.
But to craving. She was curious about Venli.
Then a traitor to her own kind. I will take her, and those you send, as my servants during the infiltration. You may join us as well.
Serve, and perhaps I will forgive your crass objections. There were certainly others thinking the same. You gave opportunity for refutation.
Raboniel strode away, though as she reached the steps, Venli spotted someone waiting for her in the shadows below, the hulking figure of the pursuer, who had been dismissed earlier. He bowed to Raboniel, who hesitated at the top of the stairwell. Their exchange was not audible to Venli.
He's begging for a chance to go with her, Leshwi whispered. Raboniel will have jurisdiction during this infiltration and can authorize him to continue his hunt. He will try anything to justify another chance at that windrunner. I fear he will ignore the nine, particularly if Raboniel approves of him.
She looked to Venli.
You must gather our people and attend her. You will not need to fight. That will be done by others. You will serve her as you have me and report to me in secret.
Mistress? Venli asked. She lowered her voice. So you don't trust her?
Of course not, Leshwe said. Last time her recklessness nearly cost us everything. The Nine favor her boldness. They feel the weight of time. Yet boldness can be one step from foolishness. So we must prevent a catastrophe. This land is for the ordinary singers to inherit. I will not leave it desolate, simply to prove we can murder better than our enemies.
Venli swelled at that. Timber surged inside her, pulsing, encouraging her. Mistress, she whispered, do you think there could be a way to reform my people? Find a land away from both fused and humans? To be on our own again, as we were?
Leshwe hummed to reprimand, glancing toward the chamber with the other fused. None had left yet. They wouldn't want to be seen rushing after Raboniel. And Venli realized, in a moment of understanding, why Leshwe preferred to remain lowly among them. Her lack of standing gave her freedom to do things others considered beneath them.
Do not speak of such things, Leshwe hissed. Others already mistrust you for what your ancestors did. You wish to rule yourselves? I commend that. But the time is not right. Help us defeat the humans, and then we fused will fade into time and leave this world to you. That is how to achieve your independence, Venli.
Yes, mistress, she said to subservience.
She didn't feel it, and Timber pulsed her own frustration. Venli had felt Odium's hand directly. He would not leave this people alone, and she suspected the other fused, tired though they might be, would not abandon ruling the world. Too many of them enjoyed the luxury of their positions. Victory for them was no path to independence for Venli and her people. Leshwe soared off, leaving Venli to walk down the steps. As she did, she caught sight of Raboniel and the pursuer speaking conspiratorially in the dim reaches of the third floor.
Storms! What was Venli getting pulled into now?
Timber pulsed inside her. Opportunity? Venli said. What kind of opportunity? Timber pulsed again.
I thought you hated the human radiance, Venli whispered. Who cares if we're going to find them at the tower?
Timber pulsed decisively. She had a point. Perhaps the humans could train Venli. Maybe she could capture one of their radiants and make him teach her. At any rate, she needed to prepare her staff to leave the city. Her recruitment efforts would have to be put on hold. Like it or not, she was going to be at the forefront of another invasion of the human lands.
15. The Light and the Music.
Logic Spren react curiously to imprisonment. Unlike other Spren, they do not manifest some attribute. You cannot use them to make heat or to warn of nearby danger or conjoin gemstones. For years, Artifabrians considered them useless. Indeed, experimenting with them was uncommon, since logic spren are rare and difficult to capture. A breakthrough has come in discovering that logic spren will vary the light they radiate based on certain stimuli. For example, if you make the light leak from the gemstone at a controlled rate, the spren will alternate dimming and brightening in a regular pattern. This has led to fabrial clocks. When the gemstone is tapped with certain metals, the light will also change states from bright to dim. This is leading to some very interesting and complex mechanisms. Lectron Fabrial Mechanics, presented by Navani Kolin, to the coalition of monarchs, Urathiru, Yesavan, 1175.
In the weeks following the assault on Hearthstone, Kaladin's anxiety began to subside, and he pushed through the worst of the darkness. He always emerged on the other side. Why was that so difficult to remember while in the middle of it? He'd been given time to decide what to do after his retirement, so he didn't rush the decision and didn't tell anyone other than Adolin. He wanted to find the best way to introduce the idea to his Windrunners, and if he could, make his decision first. Better to bring them a clear plan. He found himself understanding Dalinar's order more and more as the days passed. At least Kaladin didn't have to keep pretending he wasn't exhausted. He did delay his decision, though. So Dalinar eventually gave him a gentle but firm nudge. Kaladin could have a little more time to decide his path, but they needed to start promoting other Windrunners to take over his duties. So it was that 10 days after the mission to Hearthstone, Kaladin stood in front of his army's command staff and listened to Dalinar announce that Kaladin's role in the army was evolving. Kaladin found the experience humiliating. Everyone applauded his heroism, even as he was forced out. Kaladin announced that Sigzil, with whom he'd conferred earlier in the day, would take over daily administration of the Windrunners, overseeing things like supplies and recruitment. He'd be named to the rank of Company Lord. Scar, when he returned from leave at the Horneater Peaks, would be named Company Second, and would oversee and lead active Windrunner missions. A short time later, Kaladin was allowed to go. Fortunately, there was no forced party for him. He retreated down a long, dark hallway in Urathiru, relieved that he didn't feel nearly as bad as he had worried he would. He wasn't a danger to himself today. Now he just had to find new purpose in life. Storms, that scared him. Having nothing to do reminded him of being a bridge man. When he wasn't on bridge runs, those days had stretched. Full of blank space that numbed the mind, a strange mental anesthetic. His life was far better now. He wasn't so lost in self-pity that he couldn't notice or acknowledge that. Still, he found the similarity uncomfortable. Syl hovered in front of him in the Urathiru hallway, taking the form of a fanciful ship, only with sails on the bottom. "What is that?" Kaladin asked her. "I don't know," she said, sailing past him. "Navani was drawing it during a meeting a few weeks ago. I think she got mixed up. Maybe she hasn't seen boats before?" "I sincerely doubt that's the case," Kaladin said, looking down the hallway. Nothing to do. "No," he thought, "you can't pretend you have nothing to do because you're scared. Find a new purpose." He took a deep breath, then strode forward. He could at least act confident. Hav's first rule of leadership drilled into Kaladin on his first day as a squad leader. Once you make a decision, commit to it. "Where are we going?" Syl asked, transforming into a ribbon of light to catch up to him. "Sparring grounds." "Going to try some training to take your mind off things?" "No," Kaladin said. "I'm going to, against my better judgment, seek wisdom there." "Many of the Ardens who train there seem pretty wise to me," she said. "After all, they shave their heads." "They..." Kaladin frowned. "Syl, what does that have to do with being wise?" "Hair is gross. It seems smart to shave it off." "You have hair." "I do not. I just have me. Think about it, Kaladin. Everything else that comes out of your body you dispose of quickly and quietly. But this strange stuff oozes out of little holes in your head, and you let it sit there? Gross." "Not all of us have the luxury of being fragments of divinity." "Actually, everything is a fragment of divinities. We're relatives that way." She zipped in closer to him. "You humans are merely the weird relatives that live out in the storm shelter, the ones we try not to let visitors know about." Kaladin could smell the sparring grounds before he arrived, the mingled familiar scents of sweat and sword oil. Syl shot to the left, making a loop of the room as Kaladin hurried past shouting pairs of men engaged in bouts of all types. He made his way to the rear wall where the swordmasters congregated. He'd always found martial ardents to be a strange bunch. Ordinary ardents made more sense. They joined the church for scholarly reasons, or because of family pressure, or because they were devout and wanted to serve the Almighty. Most martial ardents had different pasts. Many had once been soldiers, then given themselves over to the church. Not to serve, but to escape. He'd never really understood what might lead someone to walk that path. Not until recently. As he walked among the training soldiers, he was reminded why he'd stopped coming. Bowing, murmurs of storm-blessed, people making way for him. That was fine in the hallways when he passed people who didn't know him. But the ones who trained here were his brothers and, in some few cases, sisters in arms. They should know he didn't need such attention. He reached the swordmasters, but unfortunately the man he sought wasn't among them. Master Lahar explained that Zael was on laundry detail, which surprised Kaladin. Though he knew all ardents took turns on service detail, he wouldn't have thought a swordmaster would be sent to wash clothing. As he left the sparring chamber, Syl came soaring back to him, wearing the shape of an arrow in flight.
"Did I hear you asking for Zael?" she asked.
"You did. Why?"
"It's just that there are several swordmasters, Kaladin. A few of them are actually useful. So why would you want to talk to Zael?"
He wasn't certain he could explain. One of the other swordmasters, or likely any of the ardents who frequented the sparring grounds, could indeed answer his questions. But they, like the others, regarded Kaladin with an air of respect and awe. He wanted to talk to someone who would be completely honest with him. He made his way out to the edge of the tower. Here, open to the sky, various tiered disks of stone projected from the base of the structure, like enormous fronds. Over the last year, a number of these had been turned into pastures for chulls, lobber beasts, or horses. Others were hung with lines for drying wash. Kaladin started toward the drying wash, but paused, then decided to take a short detour. Navani and her scholars claimed that these outer plates around the tower had once been fields. How could that ever have been the case? The air up here was cold, and though Rock seemed to find it invigorating, Kaladin could tell it lacked something. He grew winded more quickly, and if he exerted himself, he sometimes felt lightheaded in ways he never did at normal elevations. High storms hit here infrequently. 9 out of 10 didn't get high enough, passing as an angry expanse below, rumbling their discontent with flashes of lightning. Without the storms, there simply wasn't enough water for crops, let alone proper hillsides for planting polyps. Still, at Navani's urging, the last 6 months had involved a unique project. For years, the Alethi had fought the Parshendi over gem hearts on the Shattered Plains. It had been a bloody affair built upon the corpses of bridgemen, whose bodies, more than their tools, spanned the gaps between plateaus. It shocked Kaladin that so many involved in this slaughter had missed asking a specific and poignant question. Why had the Parshendi wanted gemstones? To the Alethi, gemstones were not merely wealth, but power. With a soulcaster, emeralds meant food, highly portable sources of nutrition that could travel with an army. The Alethi military had used the advantage of mobile forces without long supply lines to ravage across Roshar during the reigns of a half dozen interchangeable kings. The Parshendi hadn't possessed soulcasters, though. Relaine had confirmed this fact. And then, he'd given humankind a gift. Kaladin walked down a set of stone steps to where a group of farmers worked a test field. The flat stone had been spread with seed paste, and that had grown rock buds.
Water was brought from a nearby pump, and Kaladin passed bearers lugging bucket after bucket to dump on the polyps and simulate a rainstorm. Their best farmers had explained it wouldn't work. You could simulate the high storm minerals the plants needed to form shells, but the cold air would stifle growth. Relaine had agreed this was true, unless you had an edge. Unless you grew the plants by the light of gemstones. The common field before Kaladin was adorned with a most uncommon sight. Enormous emeralds, harvested from the hearts of chasm fiends, ensconced within short iron lampposts that were in turn bolted to the stone ground. The emeralds were so large and so full of stormlight that looking at one left spots on Kaladin's vision, though it was in full daylight. Beside each lantern sat an ardent with a drum, softly banging a specific rhythm. This was the secret. People would have noticed if gem light made plants grow, but the mixture of the light and the music changed something. Lifespren, little green motes that bobbed in the air, spun around the drummers. The spren glowed brighter than usual, as if the light of the gemstones was infusing them, and they'd move off to the plants, spinning around them. This drained the light, like using a fabrial did. Indeed, the gemstones would periodically crack, as also happened to fabrials. Somehow, the mixture of spren, music, and light created a kind of organic machine that sustained plants via stormlight. Relaine, wearing his Bridge 4 uniform, walked among the stations checking the rhythms for accuracy. He usually wore warform these days, though he'd confessed to Kaladin that he disliked how it made him seem more like the invaders with their wicked carapace armor. That made some humans distrust him. But workform made people treat him like a parshman. He hated that even more. Though, to be honest, it was odd to see Relaine, with his black and red marbled skin, giving direction to Alethi. It was reminiscent of what was happening in Alethkar with the invasion. Relaine didn't like it when people made those kinds of comparisons, and Kaladin tried not to think that way. Regardless, Relaine seemed to have found purpose in this work, enough purpose that Kaladin almost left him and continued on his previous task. But no, the days where Kaladin could directly look out for the men and women of Bridge 4 were coming to an end. He wanted to see them cared for. He jogged through the field. While any one of these head-size rock buds would have been considered too small to be worth much in Hearthstone, they were at least big enough that there would be grain inside. The technique was helping. "Relaine," Kaladin called. "Relaine!"
"Sir?"
the listener asked, turning and smiling. He hummed a peppy tune as he jogged over.
"How was the meeting?"
Kaladin hesitated. Should he say it or wait?
"It had some interesting developments. Promotions for Scar and Sigzil."
Kaladin scanned the field. "But someone can fill you in on that later. For now, these crops are looking good."
"The spren don't come as readily for humans as they did for the listeners," he said, surveying the field. "You cannot hear the rhythms, and I can't get humans to sing the pure tones of Roshar. A few are getting closer, though. I'm encouraged."
He shook his head.
"Anyway, what was it you wanted, sir?"
"I found you an honor spren."
Kaladin was accustomed to seeing an unreadable stoic expression on Relaine's marbled face. That melted away like sand before a storm as Relaine adopted a wide, face-splitting grin. He grabbed Kaladin by the shoulders, his eyes dancing, and when he hummed, the exultant rhythm to it almost made Kaladin feel he could sense something beyond. A sound as bombastic as sunlight, as joyful as a child's laughter.
"An honor spren," Relaine said. "Who is willing to bond with a listener? Truly?"
"Vratim's old spren, Yunfar. He was delaying choosing someone new, so Syl and I gave him an ultimatum. Choose you or leave. This morning he came to me and agreed to try to bond with you."
Relaine's humming softened. "It was a gamble," Kaladin said. since I didn't want to drive him away. But we finally got him to agree. He'll keep his word. But be careful. I get the sense he'll take any chance he can to wiggle out of the deal. Relaine squeezed Kaladin on the shoulder and nodded to him, a sign of obvious respect, which made the next words he spoke so odd.
Thank you, sir. Please tell the Spren he can seek elsewhere. I won't be requiring his bond.
He let go, but Kaladin caught his arm. Relaine? Kaladin said. What are you saying? Syl and I worked hard to find you a Spren.
I appreciate that, sir.
I know you feel left out. I know how hard it is to see the others fly while you walk. This is your chance.
Would you take a Spren who was forced into the deal, Kaladin? Relaine asked.
Considering the circumstances, I'd take what I could get.
The circumstances,
Relaine said, holding up his hand, inspecting the pattern of his skin.
Did I ever tell you, sir, how I ended up in a bridge crew?
Kaladin shook his head slowly.
I answered a question, Relaine said. My owner was a mid-dawn light eyes, nobody you'd know, an overseer among Sadius's quartermasters. He called out to his wife for help as he was trying to add figures in his head, and, not thinking, I gave him the answer.
Relaine hummed a soft rhythm, mocking in tone.
A stupid mistake. I'd been embedded among the Alethi for years, but I grew careless. Over the next few days, my owner watched me. I thought I'd given myself away, but no, he didn't suspect I was a spy. He just thought I was too smart. A clever Parshman frightened him, so he offered me up to the bridge crews.
Relaine glanced back at Kaladin.
Wouldn't want a Parshman like that breeding now, would we? Who knows what kind of trouble they would make if they started thinking for themselves?
I'm not trying to tell you that you shouldn't think, Relaine, Kaladin said. I'm trying to help.
I know you are, sir, but I have no interest in taking what I can get. And I don't think you should force a Spren into a bond. It will make for a bad precedent, sir.
He hummed a different rhythm.
You will name me a squire, but I can't draw Stormlight like the rest. There's a wedge between me and the Stormfather, I think. Strange. I expected prejudice from humans, but not from him. Anyway, I will wait for a Spren who will bond with me for who I am, and the honor I represent.
He gave Kaladin a Bridge Force salute, tapping his wrists together, then turned to continue teaching songs to farmers. Kaladin trailed away toward the washing grounds. He could see the man's point, but to pass up this chance? Maybe the only way to get what Relaine wanted, respect from a Spren, was to start with one who was skeptical. And Kaladin hadn't forced Yunfa. Kaladin had given an order. Sometimes soldiers had to serve in positions they didn't want. Kaladin hated feeling he'd somehow done something shameful despite his best intentions. Couldn't Relaine accept the work he'd put into this effort, then do what he asked? Or maybe, another part of him thought, you could do what you promised him, and listen for once. Kaladin entered the washing field, passing lines of women standing at troughs as if in formation, warring with an unending horde of stained shirts and uniform coats. He trailed around the ancient pump, which bled water into the troughs, and through a rippling field of sheets hung on lines like pale white banners. He found Zael at the edge of the plateau. This section of the field overlooked a steep drop-off. In the near distance, Kaladin could see Navani's large construction hanging from the plateau, the device used to raise and lower the fourth bridge. It seemed like falling from here would leave one to fall for eternity. Though he knew the mountain must slope down there somewhere, clouds often obscured the drop. He preferred to think of Eurythiru as if it were floating, separated from the rest of the world and the agonies it suffered. Here, at the outermost of the drying lines, Zyle was carefully hanging up a series of brightly colored scarves. Which light eyes had pressed him into laundering those? They seemed the sort of frivolous neck pieces the more lavish among the elite used to accent their finery. In contrast to the fine silk, Zyle was like the pelt of some freshly killed mink. His beech tree cotton robe was old and worn, his beard untamed, like a patch of grass growing freely in a nook sheltered from the wind, and he wore a rope for a belt. Zyle was everything Kaladin's instincts told him to avoid. One learned to evaluate soldiers by the way they kept their uniforms. A neatly pressed coat would not win you a battle, but the man who took care to polish his buttons was often also the man who could hold a formation with precision. Soldiers with scraggly beards and ripped clothing tended to be the type who spent their evenings in drink rather than caring for their equipment. During the years of the Sadeus-Dalinar divide in the war camps, these distinctions had become so stark they'd practically been banners. In the face of that, the way Zyle kept himself seemed deliberate. The Swordmaster was among the best duelists Kaladin had ever seen, and possessed a wisdom distinct from any other Ardents or scholars. The only explanation was that Zyle dressed this way on purpose, to give a misleading air. Zyle was a masterpiece painting, intentionally hung in a splintered frame. Kaladin halted a respectful distance away. Zyle didn't look at him, but the strange Ardent always seemed to know when someone was approaching. He had a surreal awareness of his surroundings. Syl took off toward him, and Kaladin carefully watched Zyle's reaction. He can see her, Kaladin decided as Zyle carefully hung another scarf. He arranged himself so he could watch Syl from the corner of his eye. Other than rock and cord, Kaladin had never met a person who could see invisible Spren. Did Zyle have horn-eater blood? The ability was rare, even among rock's kind, though he had said that occasionally a distant horn-eater relative was born with it.
Well, Zyle finally asked, why have you come to bother me today, Stormblessed?
I need some advice.
Find something strong to drink, Zyle said. It can be better than Stormlight. Both will get you killed, but at least alcohol does it slowly.
Kaladin walked up beside Zyle. The fluttering scarves reminded him of a Spren in flight. Syl, perhaps recognizing the same, turned to a similar shape.
I'm being forced into retirement, Kaladin said softly.
Congratulations, Zyle said. Take the pension. Let all this become someone else's problem.
I've been told I can choose my place moving forward so long as I'm not on the front lines.
I thought...
He looked to Zyle, who smiled, wrinkles forming at the sides of his eyes. Odd how the man's skin could seem smooth as a child's one moment, then furrow like a grandfather's the next.
You think you belong among us? Zyle said. The worn-out soldiers of the world? The men with souls so thin they shiver in a stiff breeze?
That's what I've become, Kaladin said. I know why most of them left the battlefield, Zyle, but not you. Why did you join the Ardents?
Because I learned that conflict would find men no matter how hard I tried, he said. I no longer wanted a part in trying to stop them.
But you couldn't give up the sword, Kaladin said.
Oh, I gave it up. I let go. Best mistake I ever made.
He eyed Kaladin, sizing him up.
You didn't answer my question. You think you belong among the Swordmasters?
Dalinar offered to let me train new Radiants, Kaladin said. I don't think I could stand that, seeing them fly off to battle without me. But I thought maybe I could train regular soldiers again. That might not hurt as much.
And you think you belong with us?
Yes.
Prove it,
Zyle said, snapping a few scarves off the line.
Land a strike on me.
What? Here? Now? Zyle carefully wound one of the scarves around his arm. He had no weapons that Kaladin could see, though that ragged tan robe might conceal a knife or two. "Hand to hand?" Kaladin asked.
"No. Use the sword," Zyle said. "You want to join the Swordmasters? Show me how you use one."
"I didn't say..." Kaladin glanced toward the clothing line where Syl sat in the shape of a young woman. She shrugged, so Kaladin summoned her as a blade, long and thin, elegant. Not like the oversized slab of a sword Dalinar had once wielded.
"Dull the edge, Chulbrain," Zyle said. "My soul might be worn thin, but I'd prefer it remain in one piece. No powers on your part either. I want to see you fight, not fly."
Kaladin dulled Syl's blade with a mental command. The edge fuzzed to mist, then reformed, unsharpened.
Kaladin said. "How do we start the..."
Zyle whipped a sheet off the line and tossed it toward Kaladin. It billowed, fanning outward, and Kaladin stepped forward, using his sword to knock the cloth from the air. Zyle had vanished among the undulating rows of sheets. Carefully, Kaladin entered the rows. The cloths billowed outward in the wind, but then fluttered down, reminiscent of the plants he'd often passed in the chasms, living things that moved and flowed with the unseen tides of the blowing wind. Zyle emerged from another row, pulling a sheet off and whipping it out. Kaladin grunted, stepping away as he swiped at the cloth. That was the man's strategy, Kaladin realized. Keep Kaladin focused on the cloth. Kaladin ignored the sheet and lunged toward Zyle. He was proud of that strike. Adolin's instruction with the sword seemed almost as natural to him now as his old spear training. The lunge missed, but the form was excellent. Zyle, moving with remarkable spryness, dodged back among the rows of sheets. Kaladin leaped after him, but again managed to lose his quarry. Kaladin turned about, searching the seemingly endless rows of fluttering white sheets, like dancing flames, pure white.
"Why do you fight, Kaladin Stormblessed?" Zyle's phantom voice called from somewhere nearby.
Kaladin spun, sword out.
"I fight for Alethkar." "Ha! You ask me to sponsor you as a swordmaster, then immediately lie to me?"
"I didn't ask." Kaladin took a deep breath.
"I wear Dalinar's colors proudly." "You fight for him, not because of him," Zyle called. "Why do you fight?"
Kaladin crept in the direction he thought the sound came from.
"I fight to protect my men." "Closer," Zyle said. "But your men are now as safe as they could ever be. They can care for themselves, so why do you keep fighting?"
"Maybe I don't think they're safe," Kaladin said. "Maybe I..."
"Don't think they can care for themselves?" Zyle asked. "You and old Dalinar, hens from the same nest."
A face and figure formed in a nearby sheet, puffing toward Kaladin as if someone were walking through on the other side. He struck immediately, driving his sword through the sheet. It ripped, the point was still sharp enough for that, but didn't strike anyone beyond. Syl momentarily became sharp, changing before he could ask, as he swiped to cut the sheet in two. It writhed in the wind, severed down the center. Zyle came in from Kaladin's other side, and Kaladin barely turned in time, swinging his blade. Zyle deflected the strike with his arm, which he'd wrapped with cloth. In his other hand, he carried a long scarf that he whipped forward, catching Kaladin's offhand and wrapping it with shocking tightness like a coiling whip. Zyle pulled, yanking Kaladin off balance. Kaladin maintained his feet, barely, and lunged with a one-handed strike. Zyle again deflected the strike with his cloth-wrapped arm. That sort of tactic would never have worked against a real shard blade, but it could be surprisingly effective against ordinary swords. New recruits were often surprised at how well a nice thick cloth could stop a blade. Zyle still had Kaladin's offhand wrapped in the scarf, which he heaved, spinning Kaladin around. Damnation! Kaladin managed to maneuver his blade and slice the cloth in half, still becoming sharp for a moment. Then he leaped backward and tried to regain his footing. Zyle strode calmly to the side, whipping his scarf with a solid crack.
then spinning it around like a mace. Kaladin didn't see any stormlight coming off the Ardent, and he had no reason to believe the man could surge bind, but the way the cloth had gripped Kaladin's arm had been uncanny. Zael stretched the scarf in his hands. It was longer than Kaladin had expected.
"Do you believe in the Almighty, boy?"
"Why does that matter?"
"You ask why faith is relevant when you're considering joining the Ardents? To become a religious advisor?"
"I want to be a teacher of the sword and spear," Kaladin said. "What does that have to do with the Almighty?"
"All right, then. You ask why God is relevant when you're considering teaching men to kill?"
Kaladin inched carefully forward, his blade held before him. "I don't know what I believe. Nivani still follows the Almighty. She burns glyph wards every morning. Dalinar says that the Almighty is dead, but he also claims there's another true god somewhere in a place beyond Shadesmar. Yasna says that a being having vast powers doesn't make them god, and concludes, from the way the world works, that an omnipotent, loving deity cannot exist."
"I didn't ask what they believe. I asked what you believe."
"I'm not confident anyone knows the answers. I figure I'll let the people who care argue about it.